Welcome back to UDEM Research and the Deep Dive. This is episode 5 in our series focused entirely on cardiovascular health optimization. Now, if you've been following along, you've already done the foundational work. You've got the baseline Mediterranean and DHH diets down, and we've really dug into the metrics that matter, you know, VO2 max, heart rate variability, and the science behind smart supplementation.
And that foundation is it's absolutely non-negotiable. If you're a 40-year-old man who's serious about optimizing your heart health for the long run, you have to have that solid base of evidence-based lifestyle factors in place.
Right.
But today, we're taking that next step. We're moving beyond the general eat healthy advice. We're diving deep into the areas where the science gets really nuanced, often contradictory, and sometimes, well, frankly, a little alarming.
Exactly. Our mission today is to cut through all that noise. We want to figure out what specific targeted decisions you should be making based on this really detailed data. Because navigating nutritional science can feel, you know, impossible sometimes. You hear one piece of advice, and then the next headline completely refutes it. We have to reconcile those contradictions.
You do. And we have to wrestle with some major conflicting studies today. For instance, we're going to look at these massive cohort studies, like one with 135,000 participants that found higher saturated fat consumption was linked to a lower mortality risk.
That just seems to fly in the face of everything the cardiology establishment has been saying for, what, 50 years?
It does, and that's why it caused such a stir. But then you have to contrast that finding with the gold standard randomized controlled trials, or RCTs, and those trials consistently show that one of the most effective ways to prevent heart attacks is by actively reducing that same saturated fat.
So reconciling those two is our first big job.
It is.
And then there's the stuff that feels like it's straight out of a science fiction novel, but it's not. It's real data published in the New England Journal of Medicine. We have to talk about this emerging and honestly terrifying threat of microplastics. They're finding them embedded directly inside arterial plaque. And the adjusted hazard ratio for major cardiovascular events, I mean, it was a staggering 4.53 for people who had these plastics in their arteries.
That is a massive number.
We need to unpack what a number like that actually means in terms of real-world risk and what, if anything, we can do about it when there are no official guidelines yet.
Okay, let's get started. We should begin where the scientific debate is loudest and oldest, the role of saturated fat and how we're supposed to interpret the data we have.
Okay, let's unpack this saturated fat contradiction because it's at the heart of so much confusion. We have two huge bodies of evidence that seem to reach completely opposite conclusions. On one side, you have the PPRE study. That's the Prospective Urban-Rural Epidemiology Study.
Right, published in The Lancet back in 2017. A monumental piece of work. We're talking 135,335 participants.
Wow.
Across 18 different countries, followed for more than 7 years. And what they found, it surprised absolutely everyone. Higher saturated fat intake was associated with about a 14% lower all-cause mortality risk.
Lower.
That's an observation we really need to sit with for a moment. To be precise, the hazard ratio was 0.86, showing that statistical protective signal.
So lower mortality, that's the finding that critics of the traditional, you know, low-fat guidelines always bring up. They argue that saturated fat has been unfairly demonized and the guidelines need a complete overhaul.
Absolutely. And you can see why. Now, contrast that observational data with the gold standard of evidence. The Cochrane meta-analysis led by Lee Hooper, published in 2020.
And a meta-analysis is where they combine the results of multiple studies, right?
Exactly. This one synthesized data from 15 high-quality randomized controlled trials, or RCTs, involving nearly 59,000 people. And in RCTs, it's different. Researchers aren't just observing, they are actively intervening. They tell one group to reduce saturated fat and compare their outcomes to a control group.
Okay, so this is a much more direct test. And what did this high-quality intervention data show when they actually reduced saturated fat?
A clear, statistically significant benefit. They found that reducing saturated fat intake reduced the risk of cardiovascular disease events, CVD events.
So things like heart attacks and strokes.
Exactly. Non-fatal heart attacks, strokes. That risk was reduced by 21%, a relative risk reduction of 0.79. The intervention clearly worked.
Okay, so one huge study says higher consumption is better, but the controlled trials say reduction is definitively beneficial. How do we reconcile this? This is where that nuance is so essential.
It is. And the crucial insight, and honestly, if you take one thing away from this whole debate, this is it, is that the replacement nutrient determines the outcome.
The replacement nutrient, what you eat instead.
Precisely. The PRE study, while massive, was heavily confounded by socioeconomic status. The groups consuming the lowest amounts of saturated fat were often in low-income countries, and their low-fat diet was mainly what researchers called poverty diets.
What does that mean exactly?
It means they were rich in highly refined foods, things like white rice. They were lacking in overall nutrition and generally associated with poor healthcare access, more pollution, more stress, all of it.
Wait, so the PRE study didn't prove saturated fat is healthy. It just proved that a diet of highly processed, nutrient-poor carbohydrates is worse.
That is precisely the key lesson.
So we should be looking at the quality of the replacement first and the saturated fat quantity second.
Yes, that's the takeaway. Harvard's Dr. Frank Hugh and many others pointed out this overwhelming confounding factor. When you replace saturated fat with refined carbohydrates and added sugars, any benefit from cutting the fat just vanishes. It's gone.
So the low-fat group in PRE was essentially swapping out butter for white bread and sugary drinks.
In many cases, yes. They were replacing a potentially neutral or mildly harmful component with a guaranteed harmful one. A high glycemic, nutrient-poor, refined carb diet is a known driver of inflammation, metabolic dysfunction, and those high triglycerides we're trying to avoid.
Okay, that makes sense. But the Cochrane RCTs, where they did see that significant 21% reduction in CVD events, they must have controlled for that replacement strategy.
Exactly. The successful Cochrane trials focused on replacing saturated fat primarily with polyunsaturated fats, or PUFAs.
The omega-3s and omega-6s.
Right. From things like fish, nuts, seeds, and certain vegetable oils. And also monounsaturated fats, or MUFAs, like you find in olive oil. When saturated fat was successfully replaced with PUFAs, that's when researchers saw that significant 17 to 30% reduction in CVD events.
That is the critical distinction.
It's all about the context of the entire diet. Specifically, what fills the calorie void is everything.
Let's talk about the practical significance here, because a 21% relative risk reduction sounds huge. But what does that mean for an individual listener?
That's a great question. And to translate that percentage into something tangible, we use a metric called the number needed to treat, or NNT. It's right. A crucial metric because it tells us practically how many people needed to change their diet or take a drug to prevent just one cardiovascular event.
And in these favorable Cochrane trials, what was the NNT?
It was 56 over 4 years.
So 56 individuals needed to reduce their saturated fat and replace it correctly with PUFAs for 4 years.
To prevent a single cardiovascular event across that entire group.
Right. It's a benefit, for sure. But it puts it in perspective.
It does. It's certainly a benefit comparable to some primary prevention drugs, but it's a modest, absolute benefit. And that modesty contributes to the ongoing scientific debate.
And to make things even more complicated, we have other high-quality, very recent analyses that don't find that same robust benefit for, you know, actual mortality.
That's true. A 2024 Japanese meta-analysis, this one looking at 9 different RCTs with over 13,500 participants, found no significant reduction in either CVD mortality or all-cause mortality from just restricting saturated fat.
No effect at all.
The odds ratios were hovering right around 1.0, which indicates no statistically significant effect. This just shows there is a genuine current scientific debate. Researchers are questioning whether some of the older trials achieved a large enough fat reduction or had long enough follow-up to really move the needle on hard mortality outcomes.
So if the data is this conflicted, what is the consensus guidance for our 40-year-old man who's trying to optimize his health right now?
The current official guidelines are actually quite consistent, but they acknowledge the complexity of this replacement game. Both the American Heart Association, the AHA, and the European Society of Cardiology, the ESC, they both recommend limiting saturated fat to less than 10% of your total calories. That's for the general population.
Yeah, less than 10%.
But if you are actively working to lower your low-density lipoprotein cholesterol, your LDL-C, which we'll cover in depth later, the AHA recommends dropping that limit even further.
How much further?
Below 6% of your total calories.
So the takeaway here is really clear. Stop worrying so much about dietary cholesterol, which we now know has a minimal impact on blood cholesterol for most people. Instead, focus all your energy on saturated fat displacement. If you're going to have less butter or fatty meat, you have to actively replace it with things like olive oil, nuts, avocados, and fish.
That's the winning strategy.
Okay, so if the debate over saturated fat is sort of the old war in nutrition,
Then ultra-processed foods, or UPFs, are the new rapidly growing systemic threat.
and what's so fascinating and frankly terrifying about UPFs is that they seem to pose a risk that's independent of the nutrients listed on the label.
Exactly. Let's start with a really clear definition. When we talk about ultra-processed foods, what are we actually talking about?
Right.
We're talking about industrialized formulations. Things made mostly from ingredients you'd rarely find in a home kitchen. They often include lots of additives, artificial flavorings, industrial thickeners, emulsifiers.
So things like prepackaged snacks, mass-produced bread, soft drinks, those reconstituted chicken nuggets, and a lot of ready-to-eat meals.
Precisely. And the risk isn't simply because they tend to be high in salt, sugar, or fat. We know this because of a groundbreaking, highly controlled RCT.
A randomized controlled trial.
Yes, conducted by Kevin Hall and his colleagues, published in Cell Metabolism in 2019. This study is critical to understand
Why is it so important?
because it controls for almost every variable that usually confounds nutritional research. They put participants on two different diets for 2 weeks each. One was ultra-processed, the other was unprocessed. But, and this is the crucial part, the diets were meticulously matched.
Matched for what?
For calories, for macronutrients, so fat, protein, and carbs, and even for salt, sugar, and fiber content. On paper, they looked identical. They were designed to keep weight stable.
Okay, so nutritionally identical on the label. And then they let people eat as much as they wanted.
Yes, they were allowed to eat as much or as little as they wanted from their assigned diet. They let appetite take over.
And what happened?
It was stunning. On the UPF diet, participants consumed an average of 500 additional calories per day.
500.
500 more calories a day compared to when they were on the unprocessed diet. And they gained weight about 0.9 kilograms or 2 pounds over just 2 weeks.
Wow.
Then, on the unprocessed diet, they naturally ate less. They ate 500 fewer calories per day and they lost weight. The processing itself, completely independent of the macro or micronutrient profile, drove what we call hyperpalatability. They just ate more, faster, and gained weight simply because the food was ultra-processed.
That is fascinating. So the sheer mechanical act of processing, regardless of the nutrition label, drove them to eat 500 extra calories a day. That isn't a willpower problem. That's a structural food problem created by the industry.
It fundamentally changes the conversation. It moves from what nutrients are you eating to what is the structure of the food you're eating. And we have observational studies that confirm this effect translates to hard CVD outcomes over time, even after researchers adjust for those standard nutrients.
Give us the numbers on that. What does the long-term data show?
Okay, look at the Framingham Offspring study. They followed participants for 18 years. They found that each additional daily serving of UPF was associated with a 7% increased risk of cardiovascular disease
7% per serving.
per daily serving. And then there's the French Nutrinet Santé cohort. They found an even higher association, a 12% increased CVD risk with higher UPF consumption.
And in both of those studies, the risk remained even after they controlled for the salt, sugar, and fat.
That's right. The risk persisted after they statistically accounted for the nutrient content.
So we have a clear signal from both a controlled trial, the Hall RCT, and long-term cohort data like Framingham, that the process is the problem, not just the raw ingredients, but how? How does the processing cause this harm beyond just making us overeat?
We can point to about four interlocking mechanisms that go way beyond simple overconsumption. First is what's called food matrix degradation.
The food matrix. We'll come back to that.
We will. But a whole food, like an apple or a handful of nuts, has an intact cellular structure. It acts like a brake, slowing down digestion and nutrient absorption. UPFs have what are called acellular nutrients, pulverized structures. The starches, sugars, and fats are released incredibly rapidly in the small intestine.
And that rapid absorption causes problems.
Big problems. It leads to exaggerated glucose spikes, rapid fat storage, and systemic inflammation. Second is the disruption of the gut microbiome. That rapid availability of nutrients, combined with the lack of fiber, it promotes the growth of inflammatory bacteria. And you also get less production of those protective short-chain fatty acids, or SCFAs, which are vital for colon health and your metabolism.
And then there's the chemical load from the production itself. I have to imagine that plays a part.
That's the third point: processing contaminants and additives. High-heat industrial processing, to improve shelf life or texture, it forms compounds like advanced glycation end products, or AGs.
And AGEs are bad news.
Very bad news. Associated with oxidative stress, vascular stiffness. On top of that, you have common additives like emulsifiers and thickeners, which have been shown in trials to directly alter the gut microbiome in pro-inflammatory ways.
And I guess the fourth mechanism is the packaging.
Yes. Chemical leaching from the packaging, things like bisphenol A or BPA, phthalates, and increasingly the microplastics we're going to talk about next.
This risk is so well established now that it's actually driving major policy changes internationally. This isn't just some academic debate anymore.
Not at all. Look at Latin America. They've really led the way here. Countries like Chile, Mexico, Colombia, Peru, they've implemented these mandatory big octagonal black stop sign warning labels on foods that are high in sodium, sugar, or saturated fat.
And those labels have real teeth, right?
They do. Products that carry those labels are barred from using cartoon characters or making any health claims.
That immediately strips away the marketing, that health halo that so many UPS rely on. It forces manufacturers to compete on actual food quality, not just advertising.
And we're seeing this approach slowly move into North America. Canada is adopting a similar policy. Effective January 1st, 2026, they'll require a mandatory front of package, or FOP, nutrition symbol, a big, clear warning for products high in certain nutrients. It's a powerful intervention.
And we've seen this kind of policy work before, forcing the industry to reformulate products before they even hit the shelves.
The UK soft drinks industry levy from 2018 is a fantastic, measurable example. It taxed manufacturers based on the sugar content of their drinks. And instead of just passing the cost on to consumers, the industry largely reformulated its products to avoid the tax.
And what was the public health outcome?
A study found this levy was associated with a significant 20.9% reduction in childhood asthma admissions, which is a proxy for reduced systemic inflammation and obesity. And it happened within 22 months. Children's daily sugar intake fell noticeably.
That's a huge structural change from a targeted policy with immediate measurable benefits.
Oh, yeah.
So what's the U.S. doing on UPS, given that Hall RCT came out in 2019?
Well, that's where the gap is pretty evident. The 2025 U.S. Dietary Guidelines Advisory Report acknowledged the link between UPFs and obesity, but they declined to issue a specific quantitative limit on UPF.
Why not?
They cited definitional inconsistencies and evidence gaps, which drew immediate and I think fair criticism from public health groups who argued the data, especially the Hall RCT, was more than strong enough to warrant action.
So policy is lagging behind the science because of debates over classification, even when the data shows clear biological harm.
It seems so.
For our listener, the practical takeaway is crystal clear. Implement your own stop sign policy. Systematically replace UPFs with whole, minimally processed alternatives, regardless of the calorie count on the box, because you know the food matrix is damaged.
That's the move.
Okay, so moving from the complexity of processed foods to a much clearer, stronger signal, added sugar.
Yes. This is perhaps the most obvious dietary villain when you look at the dose response curve for cardiovascular mortality.
It's not just that it's bad for you. The risk goes up exponentially the more you consume. Can you quantify that risk for us?
We can. We looked at a large, nationally representative U.S. sample that tracks the impact of increasing added sugar intake. Compared to people consuming the lowest amounts, that's around 8% of calories from added sugar, those who consumed 17% to 21% of their calories from it face a 38% higher cardiovascular mortality risk.
Nearly a 40% increased risk just for crossing that threshold? That's significant.
And it gets worse, and it gets worse fast. Those who consumed 21% or more of their calories from added sugar.
Which isn't that hard to do.
Not at all. A couple of regular sodas, a large fruit juice, you're there. Those people faced more than double the cardiovascular mortality risk.
That was double.
It crosses the line from a risk factor to a substantial immediate threat to your health.
That's a very strong, practical reason to cut back immediately. And what about that metric of practical urgency, the number needed to harm?
The number needed to harm is frighteningly low at those high intake levels. At moderate intakes, the NNT to harm over 15 years was 265. But at the highest intake levels, 25% or more of calories from added sugar, the NNT to harm dropped all the way to 22.
22.
Think about what that means. Over 15 years, if you're in that high consumption group, one in every 22 people like you will die from a CV event that is directly attributable to that excess sugar.
That number is just too robust to ignore.
It is.
So let's briefly touch on the mechanisms. Why does sugar cause this specific measurable damage?
It's a systemic problem. Sugar directly contributes to increased blood pressure. It causes a dramatic elevation in your triglycerides. It reduces your levels of protective high-density lipoprotein, or HDL cholesterol, while increasing the harmful LDL cholesterol. And on top of all that, it spikes key inflammatory markers like interleukin-6, or IL-6, and C-reactive protein, or CRP. It creates an internal inflammatory prothrombotic state.
And this brings us back to that crucial concept of the food matrix when we talk about the fruit juice paradox. A lot of people think 100% fruit juice is a health drink, but the data suggests we should treat it metabolically, much like a sugar-sweetened beverage.
That's an absolute critical point. High juice intake was associated with crude hazard ratios of 1.66 to 2.00 for all-cause mortality. That shows a metabolic response that's very similar to highly sweetened drinks.
Even if you're also eating whole fruit.
Yes. Even when high juice consumption was combined with adequate whole fruit intake, some studies showed it still carried a 77% higher mortality risk. The paradox exists because the fiber matrix is completely removed during juicing. You get a concentrated shot of fructose and rapid glucose absorption without any of the satiety or digestion-slowing effects of the whole fruit.
It's that rapid metabolic hit that's the problem.
Exactly.
So what's the consensus guidance on limiting added sugar?
The American Heart Association and the World Health Organization are aligned on this one. They recommend limiting added sugar to less than 10% of your total daily calories. And ideally, for optimal cardiovascular health and to get off that exponential risk curve, you should aim for less than 5%.
Okay, while sugar is a threat we can largely control, we're now going to pivot to a systemic environmental threat that feels almost impossible to avoid. We teased this finding from the New England Journal of Medicine, and the results are, well, they're hard to believe. Let's talk about microplastics.
This was a prospective observational study published by Marfella and colleagues in March of 2024. They looked at 257 patients who were undergoing a carotid endarterectomy.
And that's a surgery to physically remove plaque from the carotid artery in the neck, right?
Correct. It often happens after a stroke or a transient ischemic attack, a TIA. The analysis involved taking the plaque that was removed and analyzing its composition.
And what hidden insidious contaminants did they find inside that hardened plaque?
They found tiny plastic particles. Polyethylene, which is the world's most common plastic used in bags, bottles, films, was detected in 58.4% of the plaques.
Over half.
Over half. And polyvinyl chloride, or PVC, was found in about 12%. The follow-up over 34 months then showed a stark difference. Patients who had detectable plastics in their plaques experienced major cardiovascular events, heart attack, stroke, or death, at a rate of 6.1 events per 100 patient years.
And without plastic?
Just 2.2 events per 100 patient years.
Okay, let's focus on the headline number here because it really puts the risk into perspective.
Yeah.
The hazard ratio.
The adjusted hazard ratio was 4.53.
4.53.
It's a massive association. A risk factor that large is usually something like heavy, lifelong smoking or completely uncontrolled hypertension. This is truly shocking data. It suggests that microplastics might carry a risk that's even larger than many well-established risk factors.
And the researchers did find some biological plausibility to support this, right? It wasn't just a random statistical link.
Absolutely. The patients with plastics in their arteries showed significantly elevated levels of key inflammatory markers. IL-18, IL-1-beta, TNF-alpha, IL-6.
So the chemical signatures of aggressive inflammation.
Exactly. They also saw increased macrophage infiltration in the plaque. These are all signs of a chronic aggressive inflammatory response that drives atherosclerosis, where the immune system is essentially attacking the plaque and the surrounding tissue.
Okay, but here's where we need to be really rigorous and explicitly address the limitations. This finding is alarming, but we can't declare causation yet.
Precisely. This is an observational study of a very high-risk group of people. And while the correlation is incredibly strong, an HR of 4.53 is huge, causation remains unproven.
What are the main limitations?
Well, there are major methodological ones. There's a risk of contamination during the surgery itself, and there are likely unmeasured confounders, things like overall air pollution exposure or socioeconomic status that might explain why some patients had more plastics in their arteries.
Right.
And you also have to consider reverse causation. It's possible that plaques that are already more aggressive and inflamed, maybe due to high sugar or UPF intake, are simply more likely to attract and accumulate these plastic particles.
So what's the official regulatory response to this powerful emerging data? Has the FDA changed its position?
No, not yet. As of late 2024, the FDA's position remains cautious. They state that current evidence does not demonstrate that levels of microplastics or nanoplastics detected in foods pose a risk to human health.
The audiology societies.
The AHA, the ACC, the ESC, none of them have issued any official position statements or clinical guidelines about microplastics as a cardiovascular risk factor. The science is just too new.
So we have this huge, unproven risk with no official guidance. What low-cost precautionary measures can our listener take based on what we know about the primary sources of exposure?
Since microplastics are ubiquitous, the goal has to be reduction, not elimination. Exposure comes mainly from food, beverages, and inhalation.
Yeah.
So some logical low-cost steps you can take now would be, one, avoid microwaving food in plastic containers, especially older, scratched ones. Heat accelerates that plastic leaching by up to 100 times.
Okay, that's an easy one.
Two, switch to glass or ceramic for food storage, particularly for leftovers, and especially when you're storing fatty or hot items. Three, use filtered water over bottled water. A 2018 study found microplastics in 93% of bottled water samples. Your filtered tap water is often a safer choice.
Not in tea bags.
Right. Avoid plastic tea bags. They're known to release billions of particles when they're steeped. Switch back to loose leaf tea.
These are all steps with no known downside. They align with general health principles, and they represent a wise precautionary approach while we wait for more long-term human studies.
For now, focusing on the established risk factors still has to be the priority.
Okay, so the debates over saturated fat, the confusion over fruit juice, the clear harm of UPS, it all seems to point toward one central scientific concept.
The food matrix effect.
Let's define the food matrix clearly, because this seems fundamental to making intelligent dietary choices.
The food matrix is the physical structure, the chemical binding, and the complex interaction of nutrients within a whole food. The theory posits that the nutritional impact of a food depends on the structure and the synergy between the nutrients, the whole package, not just the isolated nutrient content you read on a label.
This concept perfectly explains why the PRE study failed when people ate refined carbs, and why the Hall RCT showed UPFs driving weight gain even when they were matched for macros. The structural integrity was destroyed.
Exactly. Let's look at some concrete examples of this in action. The comparison of dairy fat is the textbook example. Researchers compared consuming the exact same amount of dairy fat in two different forms, as cheese versus as butter.
Same amount of fat, different delivery system.
Precisely. And despite having the identical fat content, consuming the dairy fat as cheese, which includes the protein, the minerals like calcium, and that physical structure resulted in a higher reduction in total cholesterol and LDL-C than consuming the fat as butter.
Wow.
And what's more, the cheese consumption promoted a shift toward larger, less atherogenic LDL particles.
So the physical packaging of the fat within that dense cheese structure, along with the calcium, it actually moderated the absorption of the fat,
leading to a better cholesterol response. It wasn't the fat itself, but the way it was delivered.
And we see this with important phytonutrients too, like lycopene from tomatoes.
Yes. A systematic review compared lycopene consumed from whole tomato products versus isolated lycopene supplements. And it found that the whole tomato intake provided better overall CVD outcomes. This suggests that dozens of other, maybe unidentified components within the tomato are interacting synergistically with the lycopene.
So the isolated supplement, even though it's chemically pure, just fails to replicate the biological benefit.
It does. And this extends to how our bodies even process protective compounds. The benefits of polyphenols, those antioxidants in tea, red wine, berries, they aren't always immediate. They rely on your gut.
How so?
A meta-analysis on polyphenols found that the protective effects came primarily from the microbiota metabolism of plant precursors, specifically compounds called lignans. Gut bacteria convert these lignans into a highly beneficial compound called enterolactone. And higher enterolactone levels were associated with a 30% reduction in all-cause mortality and a 45% reduction in CVD mortality.
So the protection wasn't from the compound you ate, but from what your healthy bacteria did with it.
Exactly. If your gut ecosystem is unhealthy, you lose that benefit.
And this brings us back full circle to the non-negotiable role of fiber. It does so much more than just bind cholesterol. It's the engine of this food matrix effect.
Fiber is a crucial multitasker. Yes, soluble fiber binds to cholesterol, helping reduce LDL-C, but it also delays carbohydrate digestion. That prevents those rapid blood sugar spikes we talked about with refined foods. And critically, fiber serves as the essential prebiotic substrate. It feeds your beneficial gut bacteria, allowing them to produce those short-chain fatty acids like butyrate that reduce systemic inflammation and directly improve the health of your blood vessels.
Without the structure and the fiber, the entire system just breaks down.
It does.
For the listener, the rule of the food matrix seems simple. If you can get a nutrient from a whole food, a tomato, a handful of almonds, a bowl of beans, it will almost certainly perform better in your body than the isolated supplement or the refined cellular version found in a UPF.
That's the guiding principle.
So when we look for the strongest, most consistent evidence that translates to preventing hard outcomes like heart attacks and strokes, we have to look at comprehensive dietary patterns, not single nutrients.
This is the application of that food matrix concept on a grand scale, and the Mediterranean diet remains the gold standard here.
Because of the randomized controlled trial evidence base, specifically the PREDINE trial, this is arguably the strongest evidence we have for any dietary pattern.
The PREDIME trial was a landmark study. It randomized nearly 4,500 participants in Spain, all at high cardiovascular risk, and compared a low-fat control diet against two Mediterranean patterns.
One with extra olive oil, one with extra nuts.
Exactly. One supplemented with high-quality extra virgin olive oil, or EVO, and one supplemented with nuts. After up 5 years, both Mediterranean groups showed a 30% reduction in major cardiovascular events compared to the control group.
30%. That is a massive effect size, driven purely by a whole food pattern, largely by displacing unhealthy fats and refined carbs.
That's right. And we've seen similar results even in people who already have established heart disease.
With the CardioPrev study.
Yes, CardioPrev focused specifically on patients with established CVD, and it also found that a Mediterranean diet resulted in a 27% reduction in major CV events compared to a low-fat diet. The benefit is persistent for both prevention and for management.
Beyond the Mediterranean pattern, plant-based diets show particularly strong evidence, especially for men, which is our target listener demographic.
We saw this vividly in the long-running Seventh-day Adventist Health Study. Vegetarian men showed a 29% lower CVD mortality, a hazard ratio of 0.71 compared to non-vegetarian men.
That's a huge benefit.
It is. It shows the power of eliminating the worst offending foods and maximizing fiber. Similarly, the Epic Oxford study found that vegetarians were 22% less likely to develop ischemic heart disease or stroke.
And the mechanism here is just that synergistic effect, right? These diets are high in fiber and polyphenols, low in pro-inflammatory components like saturated fat, sodium, and the compounds that generate TMAO, which we'll get to.
Exactly. They promote measurable, favorable metabolic changes, lower total cholesterol, reduced fasting glucose, and even blood pressure reductions. The whole system responds positively.
Okay, let's address the elephant in the room for our listener, the busy professional. Cost and feasibility. Healthy eating is often seen as too expensive and too time-consuming, and that perception can just stop optimization efforts before they even begin.
The cost perception is partially true. Systematic reviews do suggest healthier diets cost about $1.50 more per day on average, but that average hides huge variability. The Mediterranean pattern doesn't require daily expensive fresh fish and imported specialty nuts. We have to focus on the affordable staples that deliver the most nutritional density.
So what are the affordable strategies that still capture the full benefit we saw in pre-diet?
The focus must be on staple foods that deliver that displacement at a low price point. One, legumes and lentils. Extremely high in fiber, very low cost, and an excellent replacement for red meat. Two, canned fish, particularly sardines and salmon. They provide concentrated omega-3s at a fraction of the cost of fresh fish.
That's a great tip.
Three, frozen vegetables. They're nutritionally equivalent to fresh, they minimize waste, and they're often cheaper. And finally, buying bulk grains like oats or brown rice and just getting store-brand extra virgin olive oil. That keeps the core components affordable.
And addressing the time constraint, the decision fatigue that leads to grabbing a UPF for convenience.
The key is repeatable meal defaults. You have to eliminate the daily decision-making process.
So don't try to cook a new Mediterranean masterpiece every single night.
No. Use time-efficient strategies. Batch cook your base grains and proteins on a Sunday, then just assemble meals quickly during the week, and utilize healthy convenience foods. Things like pre-washed bag salads, canned beans, microwavable brown rice packages that contain only whole ingredients.
And establish defaults for breakfast to lunch to just eliminate that decision fatigue.
Exactly. Oatmeal with chia and nuts, Greek yogurt with berries, quick whole food options that easily displace the processed stuff.
The idea is systematic, repeatable, affordable displacement, not perfectionism or exotic ingredients.
That's the sustainable path.
All right, let's move into precision and tracking. What metrics matter most?
When you're optimizing, small, sustained changes in specific factors yield big results. We often focus on lipids, but let's start with the factor that's most immediately responsive to diet, blood pressure, and specifically, sodium intake.
Sodium reduction seems straightforward, but is there a threshold where the benefit stops? Or is the relationship truly linear?
The data is very clear on this. A massive GHOST response meta-analysis of 85 clinical trials covering sodium intakes from extremely low to extremely high found a linear relationship with blood pressure.
So there's no point where reducing it stops being beneficial?
None. Sodium reduction linearly lowers blood pressure across the entire intake range.
And what's the tangible benefit of just dropping the intake slightly?
Every single gram per day reduction in sodium is associated with about a 0.60 millimeter of mercury reduction in systolic blood pressure.
And that translates to
a 6% reduced risk of CVD and stroke. This is significant, especially for a 40-year-old who might already have creeping blood pressure. We saw this play out with profound success in Finland's famous North Karelia project, where community-based lifestyle changes, including widespread sodium reduction, led to an astounding 82 to 84% decline in CVD mortality in working-age men.
Okay, now let's get into the tracking. Our listener is likely monitoring his LDL-C, the standard bad cholesterol. But we know now that LDL-C can be an incomplete proxy, especially for a man with underlying insulin resistance or metabolic syndrome.
That's the critical piece of insight we want to deliver. In the presence of insulin resistance, you often have high levels of small, dense LDL particles. These are highly atherogenic, meaning they're much more likely to burrow into your artery walls and cause plaque.
So your total LDL-C number might look okay on a standard lab report.
But the quality of those particles is highly risky. The crucial metric is the number of atherogenic particles, not just the cholesterol concentration within them.
So what biomarkers provide a better signal for our listener to track?
We prioritize three advanced markers. First, apolipoprotein B or ApoB. ApoB. ApoB measures the total number of all atherogenic particles. It's considered a superior predictor of risk than LDL-C alone. If ApoB isn't readily available, non-HDL cholesterol is an excellent practical alternative.
Okay, what's number two?
Triglycerides. These are highly responsive to diet, especially refined carbs and alcohol. High triglycerides are a key modifiable indicator of metabolic syndrome. And third, high-sensitivity C-reactive protein, or hsCRP.
To track inflammation.
Exactly. It tracks systemic inflammation, which is independently associated with heart disease risk. Dietary changes can lower hsCRP, reflecting a reduction in biological risk.
For risk reclassification, especially for a 40-year-old with a family history, we should also mention the coronary artery calcium score, the KC score.
Absolutely. The CAC score requires a low-dose CT scan, and it measures the cumulative calcification in your coronary arteries. It's not a diet-responsive marker. It reflects the cumulative damage up to that point, but it is crucial for risk reclassification.
It can change the whole picture.
It can dramatically change the intensity of the intervention needed. Knowing your score can shift you from moderate risk to high risk, regardless of your current LDL. We should also check lipoprotein, or LPA. It's genetic, not diet responsive, but it's essential for understanding your residual, unmodifiable risk.
Finally, let's address the allure of genetic testing and personalized nutrition. If we know responses vary, some are cholesterol hyperresponders, some have the APOE4 allele, shouldn't we tailor the diet based on genotype?
The promise of genetic precision nutrition hasn't quite matched the reality of the trial data yet. The largest personalized nutrition RCT, the Food For Me trial, tested exactly this. It had over 1,600 participants across 7 European countries. They received either standard advice, personalized advice based on diet alone, or personalized advice that also included their genotype information.
What was the critical outcome? Did the genetic info add anything actionable?
Well, the personalized advice groups did make better dietary changes than the standard group. But the critical finding was that adding genetic information, including APOE status, did not enhance the effectiveness of the advice. It didn't improve outcomes beyond what was achieved with simpler personalization.
So genotype is interesting for understanding susceptibility, but it's not yet actionable for designing a diet.
Mm-hmm.
What is more actionable is the metabolic phenotype.
Exactly. The LEPG-EEN study showed that an individual's metabolic phenotype, specifically their insulin resistance status, was a much more useful guide. Highly insulin-resistant individuals responded better to MUFA-rich diets, while less insulin-resistant individuals did well with low-fat approaches for weight loss.
So the practical recommendation is to focus your tracking on your metabolic status, triglycerides, waist circumference, fasting insulin, rather than an expensive, unproven genetic test.
That's where the actionable data is right now.
All right, let's run through three fast but important areas where the science is providing really granular, actionable insights. Let's start with protein quality and a compound called trimethylamine N-oxide, or TMAO.
Right. TMAO is generated when specific gut bacteria metabolize L-carnitine, which is abundant in red meat, and choline, found in eggs and other animal products. This metabolite is then linked to increased vascular inflammation and platelet hyperreactivity, which promotes thrombosis and clot formation.
And this mechanism actually explains some of the established risk of red meat, even when you control for the saturated fat content.
Yes, studies suggest that TMAO and related compounds explain about 8 to 11% of the excess CVD risk we see with higher red meat consumption. This is a key reason why replacing red meat with plant protein sources, which generate minimal TMAO and often lower LDL, is so beneficial.
Okay, next up, cooking methods and those AGEs we mentioned earlier, advanced glycation end products.
This shows that how you prepare your food is almost as important as what food you buy. AGEs form when sugar molecules react with proteins and fats during high heat dry cooking. It's the browning and charring process. They accumulate in the body and contribute to chronic inflammation, vascular stiffness, and accelerated tissue aging.
So what's the simple, practical tip for reducing AG exposure?
Use moist heat methods. Steaming, boiling, or poaching significantly reduces AGE formation compared to dry, high heat methods like grilling, deep frying, or charbroiling. Baking and roasting are a good middle ground as long as you avoid charring the food's surface. A slow cooker is your friend here.
Finally, let's touch on the beverage debates, starting with the surprising and consistently positive data on coffee.
Contrary to outdated advice, moderate caffeinated coffee consumption may actually be protective, even for heart rhythm issues. The DECAF RCT, a randomized controlled trial on patients with atrial fibrillation, or AFib, found that patients who continued moderate coffee consumption had a 39% lower rate of arrhythmia recurrence compared to those who were asked to abstain completely.
So for most people, the polyphenols and antioxidants in coffee seem to be beneficial.
It appears so.
And then the wine and alcohol controversy, the infamous J-shaped curve. We see data showing benefits, but cardiologists rarely recommend starting to drink.
That J-shaped curve suggests that compared to lifetime abstainers, those who have 1 to 2 drinks a day have the lowest overall risk for CVD mortality. Wine, specifically, is often associated with a lower risk of coronary heart disease.
But there's a massive caveat here that prevents this from being a consensus recommendation.
Absolutely. While the CV data is often positive, alcohol consumption is clearly linked to increased risks for several cancers, even at low levels. And these observational studies are highly susceptible to healthy user bias. People who drink moderately are often healthier in every other way. They exercise more, eat better, smoke less, have higher incomes than both heavy drinkers and lifetime abstainers.
So because of the cancer risk and those confounding factors,
there is currently no consensus recommendation to start drinking for cardiovascular health. We have covered an enormous amount of ground in this deep dive, from reconciling these huge cohort studies to analyzing emerging threats found literally inside your arteries. The science can often appear to conflict, but when you zoom out, the practical solutions are remarkably consistent, and they're centered around two core ideas: displacement and preserving the whole food matrix.
It's about being strategic. Not just removing a bad thing, but actively replacing it with a good thing that works synergistically within your body to reduce inflammation and particle number.
Exactly. So here are the three key takeaways for you to carry forward as you continue optimizing your cardiovascular health. Key takeaway one, saturated fat is a replacement game. Its impact depends entirely on what you use instead. The PRE study showed that replacing it with refined carbs provides no benefit and likely increases risk. To get that 17-30% reduction in CVD events that we see in the RCTs, you must always replace saturated fat with polyunsaturated fats, monounsaturated fats, or fiber-rich whole foods like legumes.
Key takeaway two, the processing is the problem, not just the label. Ultra-processed foods, or UPFs, increase your CVD risk up to 7-12% per daily serving, independent of their fat, sugar, or salt content.
Yeah.
The Hall RCT proved that this hyperpalatability drives 500 calories of extra intake a day, breaking your natural satiety signals. So focus your energy on eliminating UPFs and rigidly keep that added sugar intake below 10% of calories, ideally below 5%, to avoid that exponential jump in mortality risk.
And key takeaway 3, track the right signals because your metabolic phenotype is key. Don't rely solely on standard LBLC. It's an incomplete proxy, especially if you have metabolic syndrome. Instead, focus on better biomarkers that capture particle number, like apolipoprotein B, ApoB, or non-HDL cholesterol, alongside your triglycerides and HSCRP. And remember, the FoodForMe trial showed that focusing on your metabolic phenotype, your insulin resistance status, is a much more actionable guide for dietary change than currently available genetic testing.
So the ultimate synthesis of this deep dive is this. Systematic whole food strategies, the Mediterranean and plant-based patterns, are the most robust, evidence-based tools you have. They address the food matrix, the replacement nutrient, the sodium load, and the inflammatory markers all at once, maximizing your probability of success.
Thank you for joining us for this deep dive into the nutritional science of cardiovascular optimization.
You can find the full research, the specific studies we cited, including the Marfella microplastics paper and the Hall RCT, at research.yuda.me. That's Yuda.me. We'll see you next time.